Good morning. We will turn to our second case today. Case number is 18-14808 and 19-13269, Johnston versus Borders et al. Mr. Coley.
Good morning, Your Honors. Brian Koji on behalf of Sheriff Borders and Jennifer Ferguson.
May I please hear? Could I interrupt and posed a couple of questions to you because I'm concerned about whether or not your errors are preserved or really in a way what went on. Here's how I see this case, and I speak for myself. What the district judge did here was at the plaintiff's insistence was to transform a procedural due process right into a substantive due process right, such that the sheriff had a duty, in effect, to arrange a hearing. And when he did not do that, the plaintiff could sue for damages, and the measure of damages would, in effect, be the common law measure of damages for defamation, basically, to the character. So, the Supreme Court in Codd versus Velger, which was a damages action, which went before the court to determine whether or not there was enough to have a hearing. The Supreme Court, in effect, sort of transformed that case into an equity case. Now, here's what the court said. Assuming that all the elements necessary to make out a claim of stigmatization under Roth and Bishop, which is what she alleged, basically, the remedy mandated by the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment is a name-clearing hearing. So the Supreme Court has said that in these cases, the remedy is a name-clearing hearing. And by implication, as I read the law, it is not that there's a substantive due process right which in effect picks up and incorporates common law defamation law. Now, I don't know whether or not, if your position is whether that was preserved.
Yes, Your Honor, we phrased it a little bit differently. Throughout the case, we took the position that the measure of damages in this case, the theory pursued by the plaintiff, was inaccurate and that they were essentially trying to constitutionalize a claim of defamation against the sheriff, a claim for which he has absolute privilege under Florida law. And in our view, the case is about damages for the denial of the hearing, not to whitewash what's already out there, if you will, by the statements and the press release issued by the sheriff's office. You get a hearing to rebut that. In a normal course of action, if a hearing is held, you're not going to end up with any result, any finding. The internet's not going to delete any news, sensationalized news articles. We raised that in our Rule 50 motion as to whether or not there were actual damages to support the jury's verdict. The court denied.
Well, Mr. Koji, what in a procedural, purely procedural denial of a name clearing hearing, if that hearing is denied, let's assume in a hypothetical that there's liability because the entity at issue has not given one despite a demand for one. What is the constitutional remedy for that denial? What do you think that is?
The constitutional remedy, well, you could have nominal damages. Okay. Or if you can prove that there are compensatory damages, emotional distress, that sort of thing, that's attendant to the denial of the hearing.
Why not? Why not a lawsuit for an injunction? Courts have done that historically in this circuit. We grant injunctions and order the school board or whoever it is to give a hearing. That's what the Supreme Court said in the case I just quoted to you. The remedy for that constitutional violation is a name-clearing hearing. And I'm concerned that you may have gone along with this damages idea, which means, in effect, this is kind of preposterous in my mind. She decides not to have a name-clearing hearing, but she would rather suffer the stigmatization for a long period of time and collect damages. That stands logic on its head. I would rather not have an order requiring the sheriff to conduct a name-clearing hearing. What I would rather have is I'll suffer the stigma. I'll waive the name-clearing hearing and I'll seek damages. I think maybe you went along with that.
Your Honor, we definitely did not go along with that.
Well, where do I find that you told the court that the remedy in this case was an injunction to have a hearing and maybe nominal damages, as Justice Brennan said in that same case in a footnote, nominal damages between the time that they denied the hearing and the court ordered the hearing. You follow me? $1.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the issue that we have with that, we preserved it in our actual damages argument in Rule 50, but the reason that it doesn't stand out more in the trial is because this is the second time this case has been up on appeal to this court. In the first matter, the entire issue was the issue of whether or not the remedy of she could have sought a state remedy to get the hearing she wants and avoid
it. I'm not talking about a state remedy. I'm talking about a federal district judge. When she filed this lawsuit, she could have asked the court, as they do in a lot of these cases, order a name clearing hearing. That's what I want. The Supreme Court has said that's the remedy.
Right, and we agree that she did not.
That's aside from Peratt v. Taylor and all that line of cases. You just asked for a name clearing hearing. So what she did, and I'm concerned about whether you preserved it. What she did was say, I don't want a hearing. I don't care if my name's cleared at all. As a matter of fact, I want to travel on the damage to my reputation and collect damage.
Correct, Your Honor. Obviously, as the defendants, we're not framing the issues that they're seeking or the relief they're seeking. We do point out, and it comes into play on the cross appeal attorney's fees, that they did not seek that injunctive right. They could have. They did not do it. In this case, the way we were left to defend the claim as it was, and the claim was they were pursuing compensatory damages. We raised that as an issue in our Rule 50B motion, that they did not prove actual damages to the extent that there are damages available in Section 1983 claim. We certainly don't concede that they are, and we do not concede that they have anything to do with back pay available to her. She couldn't receive that. They put on an expert in that regard, or that has anything to do with whitewashing the internet, which is what her that's the only damages evidence they put on, and we opposed that in our Rule 50. We said you haven't proven actual damages. That's where we preserved it.
Okay, thank you.
Let me turn to another issue, Mr. Koji, which is the issue you lead off with in your brief, which is the Monell issue. Assuming you are right, that there is a Monell component to the name clearing hearing claim, why isn't this case just harmless error? I mean, the sheriff is the county. He is the policymaker. He's the one that denied a hearing. In this particular context, what else under Monell was Ms. Johnson supposed to prove?
Yes, Your Honor, that's in the response to that question, I think, is twofold. First, the court decided this issue pre-trial. So we were not allowed to make that argument. We were not allowed to put on our evidence. We could have put on some evidence to really delve into what involvement did the sheriff have as the final policymaker versus what was done by subordinates. The overwhelming bulk of what happened here was done by his subordinate employees down to the level of sergeant. We're talking about a 700 person agency. Now, in terms of denial of the hearing, he didn't fire Ms. Johnston. He didn't make the bulk of the statements. When is the right perfected? When she was terminated by Major Longo, who is not the sheriff, who's not the policymaker, he's number three in command. At that point, her claim had not even been perfected because no statement had been released, let alone a false or stigmatizing one. Her statement, if anything, gets perfected. Thank you. Her statement, her claim gets perfected down the line. And at that point in time, Sheriff Borders is not even in the picture. Maybe this court, you know, the only way to hold that Sheriff Borders is responsible is that he should have been in the picture when he wasn't. He didn't make a decision.
Well, who doesn't, in your view of the facts, who does not give her a name clearing hearing?
Ultimately, the sheriff has to give her the name clearing hearing. But when we're looking at the actual facts, who did it in this case?
Yes.
Nobody did it. Nobody did it in this particular case.
Then isn't the sheriff, if the sheriff, as you said, is ultimately responsible for doing it, and there are no subordinates that take any action to do it, how can the sheriff not be the final policymaker for Monell purposes?
He is the final policymaker under the law, but he's not in the facts of this case. He didn't make a decision. So you would be holding that we've satisfied Monell by simply not having the policy. And to us, the law is
not opposite. Having a policy. You mean denying a required name clearing hearing. If the law says you have to do X and the county doesn't do X, that's county policy. That's a county decision. That's a county action that is actionable under Monell, is it not?
No, with all due respect, we would argue it's not, that inaction doesn't amount to a policy. If we had a track record of doing it, if she had requested it and he had denied it or directed subordinates to deny it, clearly you could have that. But in this particular case, you could have, it's the same thing with any other Section 1903 claim. You could have First Amendment, the policies you can't retaliate against somebody for protected speech. Same thing, you actually have to take action to deprive her of her liberty. In this case, the sheriff didn't do anything, certainly. And the only thing he did do happened before her claim was perfected.
Counsel, your argument has expired.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Koji. You've saved your time for rebuttal. Mr. Gordon.
Good morning. May it please the court. Jason Gordon on behalf of the appellee, Jacqueline Johnston. To the Monell issue, the Monell issue ultimately is not an issue for a number of reasons. First, the joint pretrial stipulation indicated there is no Monell element. It's not included. On summary judgment, the appellants argued the elements of this claim, not with Monell. This court, in its prior appeal, set out the elements of this claim and did not include Monell.
The joint pretrial stipulation. Mr. Gordon, this is Judge Newsom. So, but is your position really that Monell somehow just evaporates for this subspecies of constitutional claim? Why would it? I mean, the fact that we didn't list it out specifically in Buxton, I mean, I don't know. We'd have to rewrite federal court's case books if that's the rule. I just don't understand that.
I understood the point, Your Honor. Certainly, if there was a negligence claim and someone leaves out duty, the argument would be you can't say duty doesn't exist. Understood. However, the issue becomes one of prejudice, that there's no Monell issue that's raised through the years of the litigation. This Johnston is not put in the position where they're going to raise that Sheriff Borders is not the highest law authority in the land. Then 3 months before trial, after jury instructions were originally submitted before summary judgment, after the ruling on this appeal from this court previously, now they come in, Monell is an element, we're outside discovery, there is prejudice at that point. But where it ultimately doesn't become an issue is this. The court, as counsel points out, the district court did rule on this pretrial. And it is for, as we cite to in our papers, it is for the district court, under this court's opinion, in Doe versus School Board of Broward County, for the district court to determine final policymaking authority is an issue of state law decided by the district court, not the jury. The district court properly made that decision pretrial. But what the district court then did is during the charge conference, during the Rule 50 conference and jury instructions, informed the parties, even if Monell is an issue, Sheriff Borders testified he's the highest lawmaking authority in the land. So this has been met. He stands by that he is charged with advising of a name clearing hearing right. This court found in the prior appeal that Sheriff Borders did not do that, and he was required to. As well, the district court found that Sheriff Borders testifies he stands by the decision by Major Longo to terminate Ms. Johnston. Again, he's the final authority. As well, because it's an issue of state law, as we note in our brief, Section 30.53 of Florida statutes provides that as to a sheriff, the sheriff has independence on numerous grounds: selection of personnel, hiring, and most important in this case, firing. So the district court properly found Monell is not an issue. It is meant, it should not be a factor, even if it ultimately is determined to be an element.
Was Sheriff Borders asked during the trial what role, if any, he had in the denial of a name clearing hearing?
He is asked that he understands that he is charged with giving he's charged with informing Ms. Johnston of the right to a name clearing hearing because of this court's ruling reversing summary judgment. And he acknowledges that he is in fact the person who is charged with that obligation. He acknowledges it during trial because as he been informed, that is the basis of what was the prior appeal. So the answer is yes.
That opening is acknowledged. Is he asked about what really happened at the time that the events took place? In other words, is he asked what happened with Ms. Johnston's case? Who was the one that fell asleep at the wheel? Who did not give her a name clearing hearing? Is he asked any of those questions?
Certainly, Your Honor, he's not asked the questions in that context, but it's important to keep this in mind. The position of the sheriff's office throughout this case, throughout summary judgment, through the appeal, was that Sheriff Borders had no obligation to inform of the right to a name clearing hearing. That was their steadfast position. We did not have to tell her. It took this court to reverse and indicate, in fact, you do have that obligation. That was made clear in Buxton many years ago. So there was no basis by which the sheriff was going to do anything other than stand by the position they took of, I did not have to inform Ms. Johnston of the right to a name clearing hearing. Now they want to come back and take the position, well, we didn't tell her, but it wasn't a policy. If your position is we do not have an obligation to tell her, you have established a policy. The policy is you do not inform your government employees of the right to a name clearing hearing. That's what they made clear. Sheriff Borders testifies at trial. He did not even know what a name clearing hearing was until this case. For years, that's the policy. And as this court has found as to policy, that effectively the argument is it couldn't be because this is the only instance. This court found in Cooper versus Dillon, single decision by a policymaker can constitute municipal policy. And that's certainly what in fact had occurred here. To the issue raised by Judge Schoflat as to injunction, the damages and such, this is a species of a 1983 claim. The appellants have taken the position in arguing Monell applies. They argue it because they say it applies to every Section 1983 claim. But when it comes to damages, now the position is, well, that doesn't apply when it's a Section 1983 claim as to damages. That functionally does not work. The Supreme Court in Memphis County versus Tatura, as Judge Schoflat notes, the concept, common law tort damages apply to 1983 claims. Harm to reputation, humiliation, mental anguish. There is overwhelming evidence in the record that Ms. Johnston's—
Mr. Gardner, are you contending that the due process clause adopts or takes into it the state tort law?
The answer is yes, Your Honor.
All right, I buy your argument. That is a substantive due process claim, a substantive claim. Now hear me now. Under McKinney v. Pate and all the rest of the cases, Supreme Court cases, no hearing at all can mitigate against the denial of a substantive right. So the hearing is irrelevant. As I understand your position, there's a substantive due process right. They didn't give her a hearing on their own initiative, and therefore they denied her a substantive right, which is measured by the damage she suffered, the stigma. That's your case, right?
The answer is, the case is that—
No, a substantive due process claim.
Your Honor, I want to be clear about the question. If the question is it a substantive or procedural due process claim?
Well, it's a substantive due process. If it's a procedural due process claim, then the case is, and it's, well, I read you the Supreme Court case. And by the way, we cited that case in the case that said he had to give him notice. We said in Buxton, what processes do in cases where liberty interests arising from reputational damage is implicated, the courts have followed a different procedural course. The hearings granted in such cases serve not to avert the justified denial of a specific benefit, but to allow the aggrieved party to clear his name, citing Kahn v. Valger, which is the one I read earlier, which holds that the remedy for no need to clear a hearing for the denials is a name clearing hearing. And the first thing that the court has to find in order to even trigger a name clearing hearing, the plaintiff has to say, there's a dispute about I'm injured. And because I'm injured, you have to give me a hearing. And if you won't give me a hearing, I'll soon have the court order a hearing. And the court will decide first, as it did in that case I just cited, the Supreme Court case. The first question is whether there was any stigma. And the Supreme Court and Codd said there wasn't any stigma. So there was no need for a hearing.
However, Your Honor, the appellee is not limited to a remedy of a name clearing hearing, because once that is denied and the position of the sheriff's office is, they do not have to inform of it.
Your argument is that the plaintiff has this right. I can have a name clearing hearing and no damages, or I can waive the name clearing hearing, suffer the damages, and the longer the period before I go to trial, the better. So if it takes 4 or 5 years, I've got 4 or 5 years of defamation and I can get money. Is that right?
Your Honor, no, because that's built as the appellee manufacturing a damage claim, which is not what we have here.
No. The damages claim was not the value of a hearing.
The damage claim.
When they didn't give her a hearing, let's suppose a hearing would have cost her $100,000. Okay, the hearing would cost her $100,000. They didn't give her a hearing, they saved her $100,000.
But they did not, Your Honor, because what they did is, with as we know from the record in the part of this as to the false statements that were made, we know that within 2 hours of her termination, a press release is put out with false information. Within the next 4 days, several newspaper articles and TV interviews.
I understand all of that. And she could have gone to court the next day and gotten an injunction for a name clearing hearing.
But she's not required to limit her remedy to a name clearing hearing.
Well, therefore, she's entitled under the law to suffer all the injury and get money for it.
Your Honor, she's...
There's another principle in the law that bothers me also, and that is the duty to mitigate the loss. She could have mitigated the loss of the future damage that occurred by having a hearing.
Your Honor, but she's denied the right to a name clearing hearing. So in effect, this court would be rewarding the sheriff's office.
That's why you seek an injunction.
But Your Honor, she's not limited to that remedy ultimately. And to your point of whether this is waived, I'd like to address the jurisdictional issue, which I think resolves a lot of what is the matters on appeal.
She did not seek the remedy the Supreme Court said she's entitled to have. That's true, isn't it?
She did not seek an injunction for a name clearing hearing. That is correct. And ultimately our position is she got that through the trial and her name was cleared. This court raised a jurisdictional question regarding the Rule 50 and 59 motion that was filed by the appellants, which we deemed to be untimely. The district court found untimely. I'd like to address that because I think that resolves a lot of what frankly is on appeal. The first part of this is the motion for new trial, the Rule 59 and 50 motion that was filed, the original judgment is amended to include prejudgment interest. That is it. There was an agreement as to amount. This was simply a Rule 59 motion to alter to include that because the judgment drafted by the district court did not include prejudgment interest. If it had, the calculation would be a Rule 60 motion. They wouldn't have even had the ability to have filed this Rule 59 motion.
Why isn't your jurisdictional argument almost completely foreclosed by our Martinez decision from 1992? There, the judgment was amended to correct simply a clerical error. And despite that limited correction, we found that a post-trial motion tied to that new judgment was timely. How is this case any different?
Because Your Honor just made the very point. Tied to that new judgment, what the Second Circuit in True Art Sign versus Local 137, what the Second Circuit in True Art Sign versus Local 137 found to this very point, when a judgment is amended, timeliness of the Rule 59E motion is determined from the amended judgment only if the motion bears some relationship to the alteration of the first judgment. We altered it simply for prejudgment interest. The appellant's 59E motion had nothing to do with prejudgment interest. This was a whole.
I'm not sure that our Martinez case contains that limitation expressed by the Second Circuit.
Your Honor, to allow, as this court did address in a case that is cited to in the McNabola opinion that we cite to, what this basically would allow, if you open this up, is that the appellant would, Ms. Johnson would have to decide, do I want to add prejudgment interest or do I not? Because if I do, I am opening the entirety of the judgment open to simply correct that prejudgment interest was not included by the district court. It should not allow opening that when there is no dispute. The Rule 59E motion filed by the appellants was untimely. No dispute about that.
I haven't taken a deep dive into this record, which is big. Did you ask for prejudgment interest before the initial judgment was entered?
I want to be sure I understand the question, Your Honor. Do we ask for it from specifically the district court in by way of a motion or by way of the pleading?
It doesn't matter to me. I mean, you could have asked for it orally, by pleading, by motion, but after the jury returns its verdict and before the judge enters judgment on the verdict, did you ask for prejudgment interest?
I did not believe that we did, Your Honor. But ultimately—
So then isn't this— To the problem that you're alluding to of Ms. Johnson being placed in a difficult position of choosing whether to reopen the judgment or not, this is an issue she could have avoided by asking the judge for prejudgment interest from the outset.
Your Honor, I see my time has expired. May I have leave to answer the question?
Yes, of course.
Okay. The answer is, Your Honor, that Ms. Johnson is not required to have asked for it for a judgment which is prepared by the district court, that if this is an error to be corrected, she has an entitlement to prejudgment interest. The district court either has to make a finding of a date of loss for the calculation to be done, which is a ministerial act, or as happened here and why this is waived by the appellants with their 59E motion, they agree to the amount of interest, they agree to a date of loss, they agreed to the amended final judgment. It's not that this was ultimately something corrected by the district court. We agreed to it. So therefore, with that, they waived it ultimately in filing their motion too late. And this court cannot consider those arguments as to the Rule 59E motion. And it wasn't preserved as a Rule 50B motion ultimately, which is required under a Supreme Court and this court's precedents to have preserved these arguments on the sufficiency of the evidence. Again, most of this is simply waived. That's the easiest course in resolving the appeal. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Gordon. Mr. Koji.
Thank you, Your Honor. On a couple of points raised by opposing counsel, first, it's inaccurate to say that throughout this case, the sheriff's position has been that she should not receive a name-clearing hearing. The sheriff's position at the time all of this happened was that we did not understand that a name-clearing hearing was appropriate based on the circumstances. We did not and still don't think that the evidence supports that a false stigmatizing claim. Now it is true, on page 48 of docket number 252, the sheriff is asked about this and he says he personally isn't aware of the name clearing hearing. This was part of the earlier procedure, but when asked about a trial, he understands of course at trial that this court said the office should have allowed her or notified her of that. Had it been known, had there been a false stigmatizing statement. So to the extent opposing counsel is implying that there was some decision made, therefore there's a policy, that's inaccurate. There was no policy, it was inaction and maybe ignorance. And in our view, that doesn't support final policymaker status for purposes of Monell. To Judge Toflat's question earlier, I think, you know, to the point that they are pursuing, they have pled the case as a procedural due process case, but they have pursued damages, as you point, to substantive due process. We preserved that by arguing that they did not show any damages, which you can get. Assume for the sake of argument that you can get something other than a hearing. Those damages are for the deprivation of your meaningful opportunity. They presented two experts on damages, neither of whom addressed that point. That is what we present in Rule 50. So the actual damage were not proven an element of the case.
Mr. Gordon says in part, Mr. Koji, that with regards to the Monell issue, that you never listed it in the pretrial stipulation and thereby never put anybody on notice that this Monell issue was going to be litigated either through discovery or at trial, and that you have therefore forfeited it or waived it. Use whatever terminology you want. Can you respond to that briefly?
Absolutely. Absolutely, Your Honor. We obviously disagree with that. What Mr. Gordon is arguing for is a hyper-technical pleading. The elements that are laid out, which were in the joint pretrial statement, which were in this court's earlier, specifically have an element that you have to show that the false and stigmatizing publication was made by a governmental employer. Our view is that's what is encompassed under Monell. Keep in mind, we have the sheriff Borders individually and in his official capacity. This applies to the sheriff's office in his official capacity. So that element, as it pertains to the sheriff in his official capacity, encompasses Monell. They have not, I see my time is up. May I have a half a minute to finish my thought?
Yes.
They have not pointed to any case law that says you have to identify and spell out the exact legal standard applied under each of the elements. The element is there. It has to be a publication by the government employer. We did not waive it. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you both very much.